I need somebody. Help! Not just anybody. Help! You know I need someone.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to what I promise will be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm so glad you're on board with us. This is Bill Arnold, and on the other side of the studio, a man who sees no good reason to act his age, George Fraser. Hello, George.
Exactly. Good to be here, Bill.
Yeah. George, we're going to try to be careful and responsible for what we say, but we can't control what people understand.
That went right by me.
I know it did.
Yeah, it was good.
It's deep.
It is deep.
It
so,
is
George,
deep.
I'm going to start with a passage from Scripture, 1 John 3, verse 1. It says, "See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him." So, we are loved. He has lavished love on us. So that is our big message for tonight. Lavished love.
Sounds good to me.
Right, right.
Ties in with the day, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So, George, how are you? I'm just curious.
I'm very well.
Alex, how are you?
Very good.
Good.
Way to be on top of it.
Yep, right by the mic at all times.
George, I know the voices in your head have gone quiet, which always makes me nervous, wondering what they're up to next.
I think we found a solution over here, Bill. Things are working, so thanks for seeing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, George, we have a great show tonight. As always, we have in studio our friend Paul, and he's going to be coming on just a little bit later, time permitting. We could get on a roll and get real interesting and never bring him on. So that's always the risk the guests run.
I would be ready, Paul. That's a very small possibility, so... But it's going to be a great show, and we're on one of our favorite steps tonight, Bill. We're on step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we carried the message to other alcoholics and practiced these principles in all our affairs. Covers a lot of ground, and what we want to look at is I don't want to go from A to Z, where I realize I have a problem and I'm going to go tell other people how to handle their lives. What I want to do is work all of the steps so I get the spiritual awakening. And the spiritual awakening, as it says in the recovery book, is the main object of the book is to get you to see and in touch with a higher power that can help you with your problem. And our higher power is Jesus Christ. And our problem isn't our drinking, our drugging, our gambling, or all of the above. Our problem is we want to be God. Mm-hmm. And addiction is really idolatry, and recovery without Christ is still idolatry. And that's why I love step 12.
Well, keep talking, George. I'm diagnosing you.
Okay. Yeah. It'll take a while. That'll take more than an hour.
But, really?
But what it does is I want to see the steps not as one after another. It's more of a circle.
It is, isn't it?
You know, so I look at three. I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. God didn't save me from my drug addiction if he doesn't have a job for me. And that's in step 12, is to tell other people, hey, look what God did in my life. It's not about glorifying us. It's about glorifying God, that he took us and lifted us up. And now we get to work with other people. And I'm sure when we talk to Paul, I know he's had a pretty successful life. But my guess is one of the things he really likes to do is share what God has done in his life through his recovery with other people, because it doesn't get better than that.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't do step 12, you're going to put yourself really in jeopardy of a successful recovery. Is that fair?
If you don't do step 12, you're going to put yourself in jeopardy of...
Why are you repeating what I just said?
Because it didn't make any sense.
Okay, let me try to say it again. Every step is important in a successful recovery. But step 12 seems to be a thought that is more negotiable in the minds of people in recovery. Like, well, I don't know how much time I have for other people. And that really is critical to, I think, a strong recovery.
I agree with you.
Did 100%. I ask that better?
Yeah, and I might not have heard it right. The other thing, Bill, is we can go from A to Z. I see this in a lot of church people where they become saved and they go out and want to save the whole world, but they don't do the work. I might be a new creation in Christ, but I have to pick up my cross and deny myself daily. Jesus said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And he also said, I think in Matthew 7:1-3, hey, take the log out of your own eye before you take the speck out of your brother's. And we don't want to go out and be handing tickets out for God. What we want to be doing is being a servant. But I think you need to work all of these steps so you're ready. The other thing is we don't stop doing step one. I want to stay in touch with my brokenness, my unmanageability.
Step two, sanity. God is God. I am George. And then we get to do this. And the thrill of it is you have a new life and you get to share God with people, because there's only one transforming power, and that comes through Jesus, that can forgive our sins and give us new life and regenerate us. And when you get that, you cannot wait. You cannot wait to share step 12, but you can't share what you don't have.
I like it. I like it. So step 12 is what we're going to talk about more tonight, and Paul's going to have a very particular insight to step 12 because he's busy at that as well.
Well, I think part of the way he's doing it is coming on here. That's step 12 to me.
Absolutely,
he's carrying the message.
Yeah, carrying the message and saying yes to this opportunity to come on the radio is, I think, for a lot of people is kind of scary. It is for you, I know.
Well, look what I'm looking at. It's very scary. You know, there's some violence. I think, you know, one of the things Bill Arnold does really well is carry the message. And the way you carry the message is by speaking, but you also carry it by being available. You are there for people. You're a first call for help for a lot of us. For me, you're about 10th, but, you know, you are there for people.
Usually when I agree with you, it ends up that we're both wrong. But this is not one of those times I'm going to disagree with you.
Usually when you agree with me, it costs you a lot of money. So
it does.
But it's true. And don't you like being available? I mean, isn't that your purpose, why God has allowed you to still be here?
Well, George, that's a million-dollar question, because if you're consumable, you will be consumed. And I sometimes think that I'm consumable, and I get consumed. And I obviously want to go out with God's strength and help people, not mine, because mine is – I've only got so much strength for me. But if I take God's strength, then it's an unlimited reserve.
You're consumable and could be consumed. I think you're recyclable and could be recycled.
Well,
and
I like
think
that,
that's
George.
What we do.
Yeah.
Because you burn yourself out and then you take time away like Jesus did.
But I don't do that very often.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Good insight on yourself.
It is. It's a little self-awareness tonight.
So if I want to tie that into step 12, now that I'm aware of it, I can change that and do something about it. And I think that's a real solid thing that, gosh, you know, I can change this. And in our step 12, if I'm doing too much carrying the message and I'm not keeping my requirements of being a family member or at work or whatever, we do get out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And when it talks about practicing the principles in all our affairs, are you out of balance? I always want to make sure I maintain my recovery, even though it's been a long time since I've had a drink.
Mm-hmm.
If I get too tired, too lonely, too bored, too angry, could I use again? Absolutely. That mm-hmm. was my solution. So we want to keep God-centered, and it's a good check. We look at step 10, continue to take a personal inventory. When we're wrong, we promptly admit it. You just took your inventory. Now you have a chance to work step 11, where you seek God's, you know, thoughts on what he wants you to do, his will for you, rather than your will for him.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it is to take some time and reflect. And maybe go on a retreat?
Yeah, I have a worship problem right now. I don't have a worshipful heart. I haven't had that in a while. So that's a problem.
Okay. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think there's a spirit of worship that you have when you are in strong fellowship with God. I mean, I can spend good time in prayer with God, but it's not very – I think sometimes my ability to worship him can take a back seat to help me give me.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily things for me. I've got a long prayer list of people that I'm praying for. So I'm always trying to petition him when I probably could be spending more time worshiping him. It's like, you know, when you go to the ocean and you go, you can just sit there and stare at the ocean for 5 hours? It's like, yeah. Or you go to the mountains and you look at the mountains. I mean, because you're just admiring its beauty.
Right.
Yeah. So how often do I sit and just admire God's beauty in my life?
Well, you know, there's a good solution to that. Maybe tonight you go take the little doggy out for a walk and look up at the stars and go, hey, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Or I'll just let you buy me dinner.
Well, I don't want to, you know, go overboard.
Yeah.
You know, I want to help. No, I find that, Bill, you know, I was able to get away for a month. And outside of the bobcat incident, mm-hmm. Up in Arizona in the mountains, you know, he's seeing all the stars that I don't see in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I seem very small and God seems really big. And when I get that mixed up, I don't do that well.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, you know, get that mixed up trying to do good things. Like I'm here to help everybody and help. And you're right. You know, I got to recharge.
Mm-hmm. You were there to play golf, though, right?
Well, I look on it as a short-term missionary trip to the golfers of Scottsdale.
And how did you do on your missionary trip this year?
I didn't play that well.
Yeah. See, but the question was about how you played, how many were converted by your charming presence.
It was fun. It's great to be back with you.
Talking about dodging the question.
Next year, I'm going to raise support.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, put my name on the list. I will send you something.
Well, I appreciate your vulnerability and your openness. We're two guys who are walking the walk that don't have all the answers, but we know someone who does, and his name is Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do our best to think before speaking, but, George, we can make few guarantees. So.
Did you change that while I was gone? Is that a new rule on
our
show?
Yeah, it's one of our new rules. It's one of the new rules for the big new year. So anyway, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, our in-studio guest, Paul, is going to join us, and we're going to have a wonderful conversation. Please stay with us. You're listening to Real Recovery. Bill and George, Alex on the board. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining Real Recovery tonight. Bill and George are in studio with our friend Paul. We're going to bring him on in just a minute. George have talked about Step 12 tonight, and Paul is going to add a lot of wisdom to Step 12 as he has paid a lot of attention to it, as he has paid attention to every step along the way. So let's bring him into the conversation. Paul, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Paul, you have had a very successful career and a family, and you have had a little, how do I put it, George? Help me with this one. You had a little experience with alcohol.
I have had that experience.
And yeah.
So I also had some experience in recovery now, and I'm
awesome.
Pleased and delighted for that.
Awesome. So in a stressful world, in a stressful job, in a stressful environment, you certainly want to change the way you feel, don't you?
Yep, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It's socially acceptable to reach for a cocktail or to join a group or to have a drink, and all of a sudden it gets to be a recurring source of comfort.
It does, and that's especially in the profession that I've grown up in now and been in for 30 years, that's mm-hmm. par for the course. It's
mm-hmm.
not, it's kind of, grew up in an environment where it was normal. It was a natural fallback for those of us who would get together and work long hours and long weeks and a lot of high stress.
Mm-hmm.
It was easy to fall back on that, and I did, unfortunately, and I mean, progressively so. As they say, it's a progressive illness.
Mm. You know, not to give you an out, but a good friend of mine, one of my best friends, is in your profession, and he showed me a study last week that came out of the higher rates of alcoholism in that profession once people get into it versus other ones.
Right. It was very interesting article, and I don't mind disclosing that I'm in the law profession. That's not an issue, but that's not who I am either.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it is easy for us who are in that profession to just decide that is who we are, and then when there are issues that come up and challenges that occur and defeats that you suffer sometimes in that profession, it's easy to find a crutch, and that's the crutch that unfortunately all too many of us fall to.
One of the things that Ed said, and he's my friend, was that it's so competitive now, and he's been in it 30-plus years, that you basically are thinking about it 24/7, even when you aren't there, and so you feel that maybe you do need something to cut the edge off, and there's a lot of built-in excuses that aren't totally untrue that can help lead to that, and it's real tough to keep balance, isn't it?
It is, and it's interesting, and I've not really spent too much time thinking about it, but we live in a 24-hour world now. Everyone is tethered to emails and cell phones and you name it. But in that particular profession, not unlike medicine, you're really never done. I mean, no matter what, there was always something nagging. One of our kids went into a profession where when she got into it, I heard her say one time to a friend that she liked it in part because she got to go home at the end of the day, and we never did. And while we didn't have cell phones and emails back then, we were never done with the day. There was always the worry of either having done something wrong, not gotten it done quickly enough. The pressures are significant. And again, that's not an excuse, but it is an opportunity.
Well, and having a couple drinks works, Bill. It does work for a while, and my guess is when we get into your story, it worked for a long time, and then
a quick relaxer, isn't it?
Oh gosh, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
And especially if you're in an environment where there's more than one person agreeing to the idea of having a drink or two,
Or being the source of the idea, and then
or the source of the
pretty
idea.
Pretty easy to simply say, especially when it's, you know, you go back 30 years and all of a sudden the people that you're working for, that's what they've always grown up on too, and so you would go along to go along, mm-hmm. and it wasn't too hard to fall into that.
And it's almost an occupational part of the whole scene or the whole, you know, in show business. I mean, there's drugs and alcohol flow like crazy, and anyone who gets into that finds himself exposed to lots and lots of it.
Right.
And it seems to me that from what that article, George, I think I sent that to you, didn't I, that article?
I believe so.
Yeah, how there is just this culture of this is what we do with fine whiskeys and vodkas and stuff, and this is just how we take the edge off at the end of the day.
Well, and so
like you say, it's
right.
not an excuse. It's just part of a culture.
Exactly. And two things. It's easier to do when you have some means, and it's a profession that oftentimes, you know, finds ourselves in having means. But what I do find rewarding is the right term, but certainly hopeful, is I don't think that culture exists as much anymore.
Oh,
I just
good.
Don't see it. And I don't say I see that because of the fact that I'm in recovery. I just don't see it as much. We really don't. And I've been very pleased, at least with the experiences I've had and watching my colleagues now today, 30 years later, I think it's dissipating, and I think that's tremendous.
Awesome.
Now, that doesn't explain the stats that we saw on the paper, but at least in the culture that I'm hanging around with, I'm seeing less of it.
Yeah.
And less insistence that you go along. It's so simple now to simply say, no, I'll just have mm-hmm. a water. Nobody even asks.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a couple things, and I'm 59 years old, and I go back a marketing guy, and I got my first sales job when I was 18. We used to drink at lunch, and we're not talking about bad places. It was Interlochen Country Club, and it was kind of the reward and the culture. But I think the laws, the DWI laws, have really brought a lot of people into recovery because you can't get that second DWI now and maintain a corporate job. And as we've gotten more aware of all the risks involved with drunken driving, you can't be a lawyer anymore and get a couple DWIs, and that's going to hurt the firm. So,
right.
You're right. But people don't really care what you drink anyway. They care what they drink.
That's true.
And you don't realize that when you're drinking. But, gosh, it really has changed.
And I'm surprised to hear the country club stop letting the caddies drink.
I'll wait on that one.
and I should say that even growing up as I did in a culture where drinking was certainly, it wasn't encouraged in the sense that, it, you know, I know that there are stories that are legendary that some of the larger firms would actually literally run the liquor cart around the floors in the evenings because the lawyers all worked late. That never happened, you know, never any place I ever went. There was never any drinking at lunch. It was just assumed. But then when the day ended, that's when it was okay.
I'm still enough of an alcoholic where I got a positive visual of that, you know, with a nice suit on downtown. Here comes the liquor cart. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
It's I was astounded when I heard that. I thought, you've got to be kidding me. But no, that's
well. Didn't
true.
A lot of those offices back then they had liquor cabinets or liquor carts?
Now again, nothing that I ever experienced.
Okay,
I think you're thinking of
Mad Men.
Mad Men. And that may well be true in that environment.
Seen,
I can't speak for that, but I never saw anything of the sort.
Okay,
like that.
The good old days.
But George, your father's generation, this certainly that was part of the culture. Didn't matter what profession you were in. I mean, a lot of business happened over lunch and cocktails.
Yes, and my dad would never drink at lunch, but he would only have two drinks at night,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then dinner. And, of course, he didn't have a problem. His son did, but you're right. It does change. But you get into, well, I guess growing up, did either one of your parents drink a lot, or was it part of your life?
Yeah, that's what is interesting. I'm always encouraged to pass along before I say anything to remind everybody nobody should compare themselves into or out of the program or into or out of any program. I grew up in a fairly normal environment. Both my parents did drink. It was part of the culture. So the home culture was, you know, Dad would come home and he'd have a couple of cocktails and then we'd have dinner and there'd be a couple of highballs in the evening. But for me growing up, it wasn't anything abnormal. My mom would be the same. But that was it. There were no other, you know, obvious consequences from it or anything like that. But that was certainly the culture, you know? And that became sort of this allure of, well, what's that all about? And at some point in time, then you get to college. And, of course, as Bill may know, when we were going into college, the drinking laws followed us. We went in at college at 18. We could still drink at 18. They changed it to 19. We turned 19. Then they changed it to 21 after we'd all graduated. So it was easy from day one, and it wasn't hard to find it in high school either. So.
Yeah, I was 18, and I could drink in high school and sign my own notes. Mm-hmm. Didn't work too well.
Yeah.
But so in college, to get into law school, you had to have good grades.
Right.
And so it wasn't much of a problem then. Recreational use?
Just recreational. Yep, just
okay.
Recreational use at that point in time. Certainly never, again, no consequences, no issues, never any concerns about that. I can look back and I can honestly say that it was traditional sort of, you know, casual college drinking.
Now, did you have God in your life at this point?
You know, I grew up with God. Grew up in a fairly devout family, but not one that was overly zealous about it. You know, we went to church on Sundays. Grew up in a parochial school environment, and then lost my dad at a fairly early age, early in college, and didn't really have a connection with church and God through college. Fairly typical story there. And then after graduation, got to law school, and then got married and got back to a church setting at that point in time, but never really still felt the same connection that I do today, for instance.
Pretty normal life.
And again, fairly inconsequential as far as not having the rock bottom that you oftentimes hear.
Yeah.
Not that I didn't have my own, but I didn't have the ones that led to, you know, divorce, loss of family, loss of job, legal consequences, none of that.
Right, right.
Which is neither here nor
there. It sounds quite textbook, the upbringing. Nice family, you know, nice house, mom and dad having cocktails. I don't know if their behavior changed or...
No.
Their just edge was off a little bit. They felt relaxed, but they didn't become irritable or abusive or anything. They still remained pleasant.
Yep,
so
absolutely.
Seems pretty normal.
Right.
And there doesn't seem to be anything that sounds too horribly offensive about this environment. So it seems safe for you to gravitate towards it. Right.
Right. Right. I think that's probably very well put, that there is nothing about that would have repelled me from that, as you sometimes hear from folks who may have grown up in a very difficult and unpleasant drinking environment. That wasn't the environment I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't. And so it was normalized for me. And but for the fact that I took it too far, I sure could be, you know, I could be a normie, as we say, but I'm not. So.
Well, we're not going to throw any rocks. I mean, come on. But it sounds like, okay, you had a pretty normal life for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I did. It's been a wonderful life. It really has, other than the fact that I allowed myself my disease allowed it to get out of control. But absolutely, I can't look at any particular event other than my father's relatively early death that would have caused or would suggest anything particularly traumatic. My life has not been traumatic. There's been not one thing that would have flipped me over into something.
Yeah. Well, George, I think what we're going to do is, after the break, we're going to start digging into the story and finding out a little bit about how things picked up a little bit in terms of your frequency and how often you found yourself in a situation where you went, ooh, you know what, I probably had too much last night, or I didn't remember this, or that detail slipped, or I want to hear the details of it.
Sure, absolutely.
And then we'll figure out at what point did you say, oh, boy, something different has to happen here, and I need to take my first step. And I would imagine that's always a scary thing, is to walk into your first meeting.
Yep.
George, is that true? For people, are they – what are you staring at me like that for?
I've heard that.
Okay. I thought you'd be more helpful tonight, but I was wrong once again.
Yeah.
We'll find out your anxiety going forward. Mm-hmm. And because I know a lot of listeners to the show, if they're struggling, they go – the whole idea of going to a meeting for the first time is horrifying.
Sure.
So you can calm their jagged nerves as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we'll take a little break. When we come back, lots more with Paul. You're listening to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. I'm so glad you joined us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio. Then across the way, George Fraser, a man, when he says things, usually generates uncomfortable stares. Like what you did tonight, George. Sorry.
How comfortable is this?
This is not comfortable at all. We're talking about Step 12 tonight, and we've got Paul in studio, and we are talking about his journey. And he's got 3 years of sobriety. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right?
Yes.
3 years. And your date is when?
You know, I don't really pay attention to
okay.
my date.
Okay, awesome.
I have an original date, and then after that,
okay.
after a relapse, so I'm not going to worry about that.
Okay.
But as we said the other night in my meeting, let's talk about today.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And we're going to talk a little bit about just when things started to change and feel different for you versus it being a nice something you felt you could control to something that got a little bit out of control. Is that
sure.
fair?
Sure.
Okay. So when did that start to escalate? When did you start to realize, maybe I'm doing this every night? Is it every night?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it all starts as it does for everybody, fairly innocently. I mean, in my case, I started experiencing it, using it even in high school. I mean,
okay.
I was in a weird situation where I won't go into all the details, but I was involved in a Navy-related group that allowed us to, in fact, required us to wear essentially Navy uniforms, which at that point in time means you can go into any bar you want and get served.
Sure.
And so, but then I kind of went back into, as I say, more normalized drinking in college. And then after college, after law school, got more regular about it, more consistent. It used to be just on Friday evenings, at the end of the week, I'd
mm-hmm.
bring home a bottle of wine and we'd share it and it would last a weekend
mm-hmm.
to the point where it wasn't anymore. And as time went on, it became more and more of a problem, more and more of an issue, particularly where there were situations where I would experience it in the mornings, I'd experience it in the evenings, but it was, again, fairly harmless. No consequences, never got pulled over for a DWI, not because I shouldn't have, but just wasn't ever pulled over.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would say that as is often the case, everything kind of came to a head initially on a date I can't give you, which is May 7, 1997, which I will actually never forget. And I basically was at a social event. Social event went on too long, way too much alcohol going on, way too much stuff in downtown Minneapolis to the point where I ended up back in my office and literally no longer conscious and didn't come home as a result. Now, a normal person would think, well, that would be the moment in time that you should change your life.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually woke up, got home. Lots of family distress about the whole situation, as you can imagine. That's when I started realizing this is not normal, and this is something that I really need help with. Began to do some looking into things, did the usual steps of maybe I'll get some books out of the library, I'll read up a little bit about this and figure this all out,
mm-hmm.
and sort of assured myself I'll just sort of stop. Again, classic behavior. I'm just
mm-hmm.
going to take care of this myself, and I'll just stop, and I'll prove to myself that I'm in control. And then not too long after that, back into the normal pattern again, controlled, really not a lot of consequences going on. And that stayed that way for many years after that. But again, more and more consequences occurring in the home life where it's becoming more and more difficult, more and more obvious that there's, concerns of, too much. I wasn't a big bar guy, not a big guy to go out and drink. And so would spend time in the evenings becoming more noticeably not present,
mm-hmm.
not present and accounted for, not
mm-hmm.
be not as reliable as I should. And then eventually fast forward to probably now 4 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, observed in myself behaviors that were clearly back to starting to look like that 1997 incident.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to the point where I actually went and on my own got an evaluation. I went to a program that ran 12-step recovery programs, ran outpatient programs, went there and met with a counselor and said, this is me. They ran me the whole battery of tests and interviews and said, I think you could benefit from outpatient, but minimally you could benefit from AA. And they sort of showed me the information that they had determined was appropriate for me. And I said, okay, I'll take this all under advisement. in the
great, no commitment on your part.
No, I love it. And because I wasn't really sure I was looking for that. And in fact, you know, the guy that I was talking to there, one of the counselors who was sort of just talking to me, said, you know, if you don't want to go into this head first, I'll just take you to an AA meeting and show you what it's all about. He said, the minimal, you should go to AA. And again, I said, well, that sounds like that's a good plan for somebody else. But right now, that's not a plan I don't think I need. And then kind of went back about the business. And then more specifically, probably like, say, 3.5, 4 years ago, it would have been the fall of 12. Really had some significant, you know, examples at home of aberrant behavior that was clearly directed to alcohol, and made that decision at that point in time that if my life was going to change, I needed to go to this thing that was some kind of a 12-step recovery program, whatever that might be, and then did, and had the conversation with my wife, made it clear, I get it now. I get that I'm not in charge. I don't know who is, because I don't know anything about recovery at that point in time, mm-hmm. other than I've heard about it. And started looking online to figure out, well, where does one go if one's going to start doing something?
Mm-hmm.
And figured out sort of what I might do to find a meeting, and found a meeting. Went to my very first meeting, and it was at that moment in time that I realized there is something going on here. I walked into an orientation meeting for 12-step programs on a Saturday morning, and I was terrified to walk into this room. I had no idea what I was getting into, other than at least I understood that these things exist. Walked in, and a guy was at the door. Two people were at the door. This guy's at the door, kind of a larger-than-life personality, and he introduces himself and says, you know, hi, I have to remember his name, but... I'm Mark. He says, I'm Mark. Who are you? I said, I'm Paul. And he says, is your first time at this particular meeting? And I said, this is my first time at any meeting. He was a recovering alcoholic former attorney and had been in the program, recovery program for eons. I could say big, larger than life guy. He took me under his wing. And from that moment forward, at the end of the meeting, next thing I knew, I was in his car and he was reading to me about what steps of recovery I needed to take. And
wow.
He shepherded me through those first months, and he was on me like a dog on a bone. and it was terrific, and I genuinely thought, this is the guy that's going to save my life here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, eventually I moved on from that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was everything sort of coalesced at that point in time, and I realized this is the place I need to be. And I'll let you ask me other questions, but the one thing that I learned in the first meeting, the first experience I had, was that this is a God-centered program.
Mm-hmm.
And once I realized that, I was in.
Awesome. George, don't you love God's showing up with this appointment to meet Mark at the door, who is a former attorney, who can speak into his life and have a recognizable meeting point instantly, because he was horrified to go.
Yeah.
I got goosebumps right now, excuse me, because I know Mark, and you talk about godly appointments. I had dinner. I have a friend that got in a car accident last week, and I went to buy him dinner, and he didn't eat. And I introduced him to Mark at the restaurant the other night because he sat at the table right behind my friend and I. Mm-hmm. So you talk about God appointments.
Yeah. You know, he was amazing in my life at that point.
Wow. So talk a little bit about your anxiety about going to that first meeting, because I know there are listeners that are probably thinking, I need to do what Paul did, and I'm feeling the same way. Maybe I can research this on the internet. Maybe I can do this on my own. Maybe I can buy some books. Maybe I can have a conversation with somebody.
Right.
But they want to do everything but, and George, you've often said, the one thing you don't want to do is what you need to do.
Right, and for me, again, I at least had I had enough knowledge and I think commitment in my own mind to know that if I didn't do something, my life was actually going to fall apart. There's no question about that. I knew that. And so, you know, I've had to screw up. Fortunately, again, as part of my profession, you have to screw up your courage enough times to do whatever it is you're charged with doing, and I'd done that enough times. And so walking into this, because it was represented to be an orientation meeting where I didn't have to do anything, just walk in the door and sit down and drink a cup of coffee. And mm-hmm. there was literally no expectations of me at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured that out. I didn't know that Mark was going to have all kinds of expectations for me, as it turned out. But you know, once I got to that point, it didn't end there. The anxiety didn't end there because Mark said after that first meeting, well, here's what you're going to do. And he didn't put me on the 30 days, you know, 30 meetings or 30 days routine, but he did say, you're going to have to go to a meeting. You're going to have to go to something besides this. This is an orientation meeting. Mm. But you're going to have to find a meeting to go to. And he said, here's some examples. He gave me a book. And I went to the first meeting, I think that week, at a church in Edina. And I was what Mark called the classic drive-by. I didn't even go in. I shouldn't say that. I went in, but I couldn't quite figure out if I knew what room it was.
And I passed
a room that they had some people in, and I passed it again, and I thought, well, that can't be it. And since I can't find it, I guess I'll go home.
Yeah. Fabulous.
I love that.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
And I'm sure that was the meeting. I don't know. They didn't have any signage up. It was kind of a casual thing going on. But, again, I talked to Mark about it. And Mark said, well, so you're a drive-by, but that's not, you know, that's not good enough. Let's find another one where you could actually find out. And then I found another meeting in Bloomington that, I walked in there a little less anxious because I had already experienced at least one meeting.
Okay.
Walked into them, big group of guys, had no idea what I was getting into, and they embraced me immediately.
Awesome. Now, talk about what happened with some of the stories you heard in there and how you were feeling emotionally when you heard some of these stories that you were having a little trouble relating to.
Yeah, and that gets me back again to repeating my earlier comment of not allowing myself or anybody else to compare your way out of the program. Because I went in there and I was, you know, this wasn't a big book meeting. This was a pretty much just a meeting of people who wanted to help their, you know, somebody would read and then everybody would talk and take turns. And they did do a first step that night for me, which I didn't know what that was, but I figured out pretty well. And I really did hear horror stories, things that weren't even close to my experience. I mean, I won't, but I could go into details that were just astounding to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I did sit there and think, I don't know what I'm doing here. This can't possibly be the right kind of thing for me because I don't have these kinds of stories. I haven't had these kinds of consequences. But I knew that I still needed to go, and they were very encouraging. And again, so I continued to go. I told my story that evening, and they were great about it. And I didn't know this phrase, don't compare your way out, until several months later when I was attending another larger meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women who was speaking and telling her story made that comment. And that was moving and kind of connected with me.
And the compare your way out comment suggests that you go in there and you listen to the other stories and you go, these people are way more messed up than me. I don't need to be here. Is that kind of what
right, compare? Right, exactly. That either, you know, comparing your way out because you haven't hit that level of consequence.
I see.
That's the last thing because, as they also point out, everybody has their own bottom. And it doesn't make any difference that I'm not on any DWIs or my fifth DWI.
Right.
Either way, the question is, do I understand that my life has become unmanageable and that I need to turn my will over to God? And the more I've heard that, the more I realize that's exactly what I need.
Awesome.
And that's exactly what I've needed when I walked in the room.
Awesome. All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we have one more segment with Paul, so stay tuned. I hope you're enjoying tonight's Real Recovery. We're so glad you're with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio. George Fraser across the way. Growing up, someone had to set a bad example. Thank you, George.
Glad I could do that.
Thank you. Thank you. But look at the good you're doing now. I mean, you're Mr. 12-step. 12-step.
If I become Mr. 12-step, I'll be Mr. Back in Treatment. Now, just struggling with the
mean?
Recovery.
What does that mean?
Well, you never want to say you've arrived, and
oh,
you want to be
not.
As humble and
oh,
willing
course.
To do what you will. And I know you were joking.
I'm just saying you spend a lot of time and energy trying to help others.
Well,
and
God,
to me, I think that's what 12-step is, right?
God set my life up so I could do it.
Okay.
You know? And we were just talking about running into a guy, Mark, who changed his life completely. Mm-hmm. We just saw him at dinner the other night.
Mm-hmm. Don't say that we go to dinner on the air.
I buy you dinner once a week.
Okay.
Now, this will be two this time. Here's what I'm interested about in the story. We go back to 1997 in May. I got a good
chance here to say, hey, maybe I should quit. But you know what? If I can control this, that means not drink for a while, then I don't have to stop doing this, mm-hmm. okay? And that's what we always do. We want to find an easier, softer way because I want to hold on to the right to drink, okay? Because if I quit, gone. So we go from 1997 to 2012, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's patient, and it's cunning, and it's baffling, and it's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a warning there, and it's in the back of my mind. But I think God has to touch our hearts and go, this is a moment of mental clarity. I didn't have it. God touches me and goes, you know, you're a smart guy in all the areas of your life, but you
can't. God didn't say that, did he?
To him,
oh,
not to
no,
me.
No, no, but I can picture him saying to Paul, yeah.
He didn't say that to me. He didn't say that to
no,
me
No, I can't
all.
Imagine that. No, I know God, and
no,
he wouldn't have said that to you.
It's a God of truth. It's a God of truth.
Exactly.
I have been stagnating, though.
You have been stagnating.
And he says, you can't rule this out intellectually, which is one of your greatest gifts and also one of your big defenses. You can't rationalize this away that you don't have a problem. And I want to give you credit, and I think God changes our heart. I'm going to take some action here. And God honors that by putting a guy in his way that's going to change his life because somebody did that for him.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're doing it here. It's a great deal. And that's step 12 to me.
It's fantastic. It really is. So, Paul, you've got a big book here with several dogged ears and Post-it notes. And I bet there's a couple of things that have hit you and have affected your life in a way that you probably want to share.
Well, I've got dogged stuff in here. And I got writing here that Mark wrote when I first got the book from him.
Oh, but awesome.
I don't have any magic to this, and I'm not going to call myself an expert on all this. What I know and what always resonates with me is what I heard again the other evening, which was I saw two guys getting a 26-year medallion and a 28-year medallion for years of sobriety. And each of them kind of said the same thing, which is, you know, good for me, but that's not the point. The point is today is 24 hours, and as long as today – I hang on to the four words, thy will be done, I'm mm-hmm. going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I have felt myself stepping back in, you know, to the brink or up to the brink or feeling like I'm getting out of control, or back when I had a relapse experience a long time ago, I know it's because I didn't hold firm to the steps where it's clear it's, you know, my life's unmanageable and I don't have any control over this, but God is. But God does have a way to control mm-hmm. it. And if I do turn it over to him each and every morning, each and every evening, and just live that day, that's what's kept me sober, is knowing that God is in charge, not me. If I'm trying mm-hmm. to play the actor, as the book says, I'm that's what I do for a living, is I play that actor. I mm-hmm. control the stage. But this isn't the stage that I should be trying to control.
So. I love that book in front. I think it's on page 83. It could be wrong, but it says, upon awakening, we turn our thoughts to God and what he would have us do that day.
Right.
It also talks about that at night. We thank him for our sobriety. Thy will be done. And when we say the third step prayer, you know, relieve me of the bondage of self so I may better do your will, not his will. His will for me, not my will for him. And when you get into recovery, what you see is his plan is a lot better than my plan for me. But that's a big leap for a lot of us, and one we have to do every day.
And I count myself among the lucky ones that came into a program like this with a already established, I'm not going to say established relationship, but an already established understanding that there is a higher power as the steps call him, but as Jesus Christ and God, for me, mm-hmm. I don't have any dispute about that. And again, this is, you know, the programs that I go to, the recovery that I'm in, nobody has an issue with the fact, and nobody would have an issue with the fact that I understand who my higher power is. But I can understand how people who would come into it and think, well, I don't do that. They still need to come into the program because it is a higher power as you understand it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to understand it the way I do or that you do or the Bill does. You just have to understand that you're not in charge and that there is a higher power who is.
It's very interesting. One of the guys that I saw get sober was a guy named Dick B. And Dick B. was studying to be a Maronite priest at one time, but didn't do that and drank for 30 years. And
I took him to a group of recovering people, and he got one of the books and read it, and he was, with his spiritual background in the Catholic Church, off and running, because this makes sense to me. This is truth. And I think having had a relationship with God and a church background really sets you up, and you go, hey, this is the Bible, Scripture, with numbers to it. That's all Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and the first 100 men and women did, is they numbered Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And it is based on the Word of God, so it is truth, so it's going to work.
Right.
And it does.
Right. And I love to revisit Paul's line when he just said, you know, God as you understand him. And I think the originators, Dr. Bob and Bill W., is that their names?
Well, they got that from the Oxford group.
The Oxford group. And they said, wherever you are at your understanding of God. I mean, a lot of people have a relationship with God without knowing a whole lot about him. And then they start a relationship with God and then grow in the understanding of him.
Right. The Oxford group was a Christian group. And it was really, God as you understand him, was how far along you were in your relationship with Jesus Christ. It got watered down in 1939 when they wrote the book. And the recovery rates in Alcoholics Anonymous, from everything I've read, starting in 1935, were a lot higher before they wrote the book, because they used the Bible and got down on their knees to pray. One of the early groups was called the James Gang, because they read out of the book of James. And so the truth hurt. The danger is that the power could be the group or higher power. We don't have a higher power. We have the highest power, and that's God. There is one God. You know, I mm-hmm. am who I am, mm-hmm. and then his son Christ. We see that reflected of God, who God is through Jesus. And that's really important, I think, Bill.
I agree.
Because if I have a false God, my recovery's got to be a big event deal. Because my using was a big event deal, and I have a big event God, okay? And that's step 12 to me. And tonight, you know, listen to what he's done in your life. This is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You thought it was probably going to be the worst thing that ever happened. You got to quit drinking.
Well, yeah, it's again, we were talking about this the other night in the meeting I was at, which was, it's always, you know, I learn something at every single meeting I go to.
There's really?
Always, absolutely, wow. I absolutely do, and I just kick myself for not bringing a little book and writing it all down. But every time somebody says something, there's a twist to it, there's a nuance, or there's just a different perspective, you know. But you know, the comment that was made was about 12 step, and also about how, you know, how we have to have God in the life in order to do any of these steps. But, you know, the focus the other night was how we need to make this part of our lives. It's not, you know, 12 step is not just, bringing other alcoholics together, but it's also the phrase that to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And, you know, the perspective that he brought was he hadn't spent a lot of time. This is a guy with 28 years of recovery, and he was focusing again how this isn't about my 28 years of recovery or 26, it was about today, and that he had to go forward today. And one of the things that even he, after all those years, needed to work on was practicing him in all his affairs, practicing these principles. And that's a big deal.
I love that. You know, we got one day at a time, the recovery groups did, out of Matthew 6:34. Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Jonathan Edwards, the Puritan preacher, said that God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, I think, when people get recovery medallions, and I think they are a big deal, but it's not about us. It's about what God did in our lives, that the living God took a person who was dead and pulled them back up. And this is 28 years. This is 26 years. And we go down, we're talking about Mark. Look at all the things that have happened because God picked Mark up, and Mark has been obedient and willing to carry the message. We're looking at least one person, and there's probably hundreds. And that's how the kingdom of God, it's like a mustard seed.
Mm-hmm.
We lift people up, and that's how it works. And it's really cool to see it, I think.
And it's great.
There's a Christian singer who just accidentally, again, there's so many things that occur in life that you think are just fate or God's hand, but she has a line in one of her songs, and she says she's praying to God in the song, and she says, I see the great things, I see the things you do through me as great things I have done. And that's always struck me as if I can just keep that in mind, that that's got nothing to do with me, everything that I've done, good, bad, or indifferent, the bad I've done on my own, the good are only through the grace of God and through his will, not mine. And that's what you have to kind of, that's the part. That's always the part of this program that has kept me going. So.
I love that. I mean, in looking at your story, if you really wanted to quit drinking, you would have done it at 97.
Right.
God changed your heart. Same for me. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to quit drinking. Are you kidding me? I love drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Love going to jail every weekend. But it changes. And then you go, gosh, this is what God created you to do.
Right.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's an awesome story. I just love it. And I know, Paul, there's going to be people listening tonight. We just have a minute left. But give them a little word of hope about if they need to get to that first meeting, it's going to be okay.
It will be okay. And I just really do encourage you, don't worry about, you know, if yours is a more of a train wreck story or yours isn't even as bad as my story, whatever it is, there is help that's out there. We live in a wonderful country, in a particularly wonderful state and community. There are so many resources. Mm. The group that I belong to alone, the facility, I think probably has 20 meetings a day. Practically, it's remarkable.
Wow.
So I do encourage you, don't wait the 15 years between the obvious day and the day you finally show up, because it makes it. I first showed up and realized I should have been here 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well, George, that wraps up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. So we're so glad you joined us tonight. And if you want to hear more of this story or pass it on to a friend, you can go to myfaithradio.com and go to the podcast. It should be up soon. And you can pass it on to friends. Good night, everyone.